You are now listening to the OrthoBullets podcast.
This episode of the OrthoBullets podcast will go over the topic of tibial tubercle fracture from the pediatric section on orthobullets.com. Tibial tubercle fractures are a common fracture that occurs in adolescent boys near the end of skeletal growth during athletic activity. Treatment is usually casting or surgical fixation, depending on the degree of displacement. As far as epidemiology, the incidence is less than 1% of all pediatric fractures. As far as demographics, males sustain these injuries much more commonly than females, and they typically occur in people ages 12 to 15 or those that are approaching skeletal maturity. As far as risk factors, these injuries are most common in basketball, football, sprinting, and high jump. Pathophysiology, the mechanisms of injury is a concentric contraction of the quadriceps during jumping and an eccentric contraction of the quadriceps during forced knee flexion. Associated conditions can include a compartment syndrome in 4% of cases and meniscal tears with type 3 tibial tubercle fracture injuries. As far as prognosis, there is a high rate of fracture union and return to sports with appropriate treatment, and there is a low incidence of leg length discrepancy given the age at which this injury occurs. With respect to the anatomy, let's briefly go over the osteology, muscles, and blood supply. As far as relevant osteology, the proximal tibia has two ossification centers. The primary ossification center is the proximal tibial physis, and the secondary ossification center is the tibial tubercle physis or apophysis, which is the insertion of the patellar tendon. Physeal closure occurs from posterior to anterior and proximal to distal, with the tibial tubercle the last to fuse, and this places the distal secondary center at greater risk of injury in older children. As far as muscles, the extensor mechanism exerts great force at the secondary ossification center, and the relevant blood supply to remember is the recurrent anterior tibial artery can be lacerated in tibial tubercle fractures, and this is definitely a question that comes up on board exams. As far as the classification of tibial tubercle fractures, it's based on the level of the fracture and the presence of a fracture displacement. Type 3 is typically the most common. But to go over this classification system, it is known as the Ogden classification or the modification of the Watson-Jones classification, and there are five different types. Type 1 is a fracture of the secondary ossification center near the insertion of the patellar tendon. Type 2 is a fracture that propagates proximal between primary and secondary ossification centers. Type 3 is a coronal fracture extending posteriorly to cross the primary ossification center. Type 4 is a fracture through the entire proximal tibial physis, and type 5 is a periosteal sleeve avulsion of the extensor mechanism from the secondary ossification center. As far as presentation of these injuries, symptoms include sudden onset of pain, which generally occurs during the initiation of jumping or sprinting. Patients will typically have inability to immediately ambulate, and they'll have knee swelling / hemarthrosis with type 3 injuries. On physical exam, inspection and palpation will reveal a knee effusion, tenderness at the tibial tubercle, and remember to evaluate for anterior compartment firmness. As far as range of motion and instability, there may be an extensor lag or extensor deficiency in type 2 or 3 injuries, and retinacular fibers may allow for active extension. On neurovascular exam, monitor for increasing pain suggestive of compartment syndrome. As far as imaging, recommended views on radiographs include AP and lateral, and some optional views include an internal rotation view, which will bring the tibial tubercle into profile, and comparison views of the contralateral knee in younger pediatric patients. As far as the findings that you may see widening or hinging open of the apophysis. A fracture line may be seen extending proximally and at a variable distance posteriorly. Sometimes anterior swelling may be the only sign in the setting of a periosteal sleeve injury, which is again a type 5 injury, and you may also see patella alta. CT can be useful to evaluate for intraarticular or posterior extension. An arteriogram can also be obtained if there's a concern for a popliteal artery injury. However, this should not delay intervention in the setting of a compartment syndrome. An MRI is generally not indicated, but it can be useful for determining fracture extension in a non-displaced type 2 injury or a type 5 injury. As far as treatment, non-operative management consists of a long leg cast and extension for 6 weeks, and the indications include type 1 injuries or those with minimal displacement of less than 2 millimeters. Another indication can be acceptable displacement after close reduction / cast application. Operative options include an open reduction internal fixation with arthrotomy, plus or minus arthroscopy, and plus or minus soft tissue repair. And this is indicated in type 2 through 4 fractures, as you need to visualize the joint surface for perfect reduction and evaluate for intra-articular pathology. Soft tissue repair for type 5, that is a periosteal sleeve fracture, is often indicated. As far as techniques for open reduction and internal fixation, the approach is a midline incision to the fracture line, and the technique will be to evaluate and clean the fracture site, remove any soft tissue or periosteum interposition, anatomic reduction of the fracture fragments, and internal fixation with 4-0 cancellous partially threaded screws. Larger screws can be used but may cause soft tissue irritation in the long term. And smooth K-wires should be used in younger children that are greater than 3 years from skeletal maturity. As far as postoperative care, immobilization and non-weight-bearing in a long leg cast or brace for 4 to 6 weeks is the typical protocol. As far as rehabilitation, progressive extensor mechanism strengthening is the name of the game, and return to sports no sooner than 3 months. As far as pros and cons of open reduction and internal fixation, the pros include anatomic reduction and stable fixation, excellent healing potential, and this may also allow for earlier range of motion. However, the cons include incision and associated complications, and hardware irritation can necessitate implant removal. Open reduction and internal fixation with arthrotomy or arthroscopy, the approach here, midline approach and parapatellar arthrotomy, the joint surface must be visualized to assure anatomic reduction, and alternatively, arthroscopy can be used to directly assess the articular reduction. As far as technique, it's very similar to the open reduction and internal fixation. Make sure to evacuate the intra-articular hematoma, visualize the joint surface to achieve anatomic reduction, evaluate for meniscus tears and repair or debride as appropriate, and if soft tissue repair is indicated, of course do that as well. Postoperative care will again include immobilization in a long leg cast for 4 to 6 weeks and non-weight bearing. Rehab is again identical to the open reduction and internal fixation protocol with progressive extensor mechanism strengthening and return to sports at 3 months. Pros and cons. The pros of this approach is to address intra-articular extension and soft tissue injuries, and the cons are that the arthrotomy may require longer immobilization and or rehabilitation. As far as soft tissue repair, the approach is again midline incision to the fracture site, and the technique is to obviously evaluate the soft tissue injury, remove any soft tissue interposition like periosteum, and heavy suture repair of the periosteum back to the secondary ossification center is typically the technique. Postoperative care, immobilization, long leg cast for 8 to 10 weeks, and prolonged immobilization is needed due to soft tissue rather than bone healing. Rehab includes, again, progressive extensor mechanism strengthening and return to sports no sooner than 3 months. The cons for soft tissue repair is, of course, prolonged healing time given soft tissue healing. As far as complications, the Rieker-Vadim deformity is more common than leg length discrepancy, and the Rieker-Vadim deformity occurs because you will have a growth arrest anteriorly and then posterior growth continues, leading to a decrease in tibial slope. Compartment syndrome is the major complication to be aware of, and this again is related to injury of the anterior tibial recurrent artery. Other complications include stiffness, bursitis, which is the most common complication following surgical repair due to prominence of screws and hardware around the knee, and this of course resolves upon hardware removal. And finally, vascular injury is also something to be aware of, and this typically presents in the form of a popliteal artery injury as it passes posteriorly over the distal metaphyseal fragment. That's all for this review on tibial tubercle fractures. Look out for questions related to this topic on this weekend's question session, and hopefully this episode will have prepared you for that review. This is the OrthoBullets podcast, a daily audio review session by OrthoBullets, the free learning and collaboration community for orthopedic surgery education. If you're enjoying the podcast so far, please consider leaving us a 5-star review on iTunes. It will help us spread the word and increase our discoverability tremendously. Thanks so much, and we'll see you all tomorrow.